Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and welcome back, Dr. Bob Gwaither, to our show.
Thanks so much, Adam. It's good to be here.
We are going to have to give you an honorary co-host. You have been really a rock, and we really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. On our show today, we're going to be talking about monitoring marijuana use as attitudes, behaviors, and legislation change with Dr. Alejandro Azofefo with Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. He's an epidemiologist. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I'm going and have already begun to learn a lot.
And me too. That's been interesting, especially the parts about this exploding marijuana use.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about some recent changes around the country as well. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. And our very first one is about television cooking shows and safe food handling practices. You ever look at television cooking shows?
I have to admit that I have. And they're interesting, and it turns out a lot of people do get instruction about how to prepare meals from the television cooking shows, especially the ones that are, you know, reproducible with good recipes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I see the one where, you know, there's three different teams and they have different things they have to prepare, and one you know, loses. And what I'm always amazed at is that they can make these gourmet meals in like minutes, and I see them chopping so fast. I'm like, if I did that, I would be cutting my hands everywhere.
That's a good segue into what the problem that is being addressed in this article is, because those people certainly are sloppy when they prepare their food, that's for sure. Anyway, it turns out television cooking is an important resource for home cooks. And the University of Massachusetts Amherst devised a study to assess food safety on television food shows and determine whether or not they're presenting a positive or negative models. This is reported by Nancy L. Cohn, Ph.D.
in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior.
Right.
Yeah, I found it amazing, Bob, that I guess like a fifth of consumers use cooking shows as their primary source of, you know, major information about food. And 50% of respondents watch some television cooking shows, and a little over 50% report purchasing some items based upon these. So these are major influences of behavior.
And they're looking to see about hand washing behaviors, handling food, cooking to the required temperatures, separating meat and poultry from ready to eat foods, and other things. And so they had the researchers watch a lot of these shows and rate them. And the truth was that 70% of the food and safety practices did not occur on these shows. And it's sort of shameful that, well, at least in the minds of the authors, that we're not demonstrating what we need to do.
Yeah, yeah. And less than half of the only four shows was more than 50% of the episodes like in compliance. And so it really raises a question, as you would with any representation on TV of real life, should that represent an aspect of real life? And I think we would tend to say it should, and we should pointed out, maybe there needs to be some media literacy training about food shows.
Well, just to say a little pushback on that, just doing this radio show makes me know how complicated it is to actually produce something. And if you had to do these competing chefs with each other and taking away items that they can use in their recipes and all this stuff, it would be impossible to do that right, I think.
Well, at least we can show them washing their hands.
Yeah, we could. We could and should, no doubt.
Well, speaking of interesting research, our next one, Bob, you and I both think this is really important, and it's social networking by doctors. Huh? What's that about?
Well, this is a very good surgical study that looks at 251,000 older Americans who had bypass surgery and who took care of them and how well connected those people are. And they came up with some social networking calculations and tried to figure out if there was good networking among the physicians that took care of them and less well if they didn't.
Yeah, this was published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation, and really looking at kind of outcomes of surgery. And so you would think, oh, outcomes of surgery only really depend on the care of the and the quality of the surgeon. And the answer is that's really doesn't appear true. That you took two different communities in Texas, and one that was doctors kind of knew each other. The primary care doctor maybe knew the surgeon knew the anesthesiologist. And it appears as if perhaps they got better care the more tightly these social networks knew each other.
And the results are actually sort of impressive because 25% increase in the measure of this teamwork associated with 17 fewer admissions to the ER or the hospital within a month after the operation. And if you want to do other things for comparison, if you look at measure of education among patients, it's only one admission more than that. And if you look at how complex and how sick the patients were, it only has one admission per 1,000 patients back to the hospital. And so it doesn't have much of an effect at all.
Yeah, I think this is a really quick, easy thing to implement, which is if you're going to have surgery, ask your doctor, tell me how well in your health system, and maybe the health system needs to report on how well connected their physicians are to one another and their teams are connected. Really important research. Our next one is about pregnant women and thyroid medication, because 2 to 3% of pregnant women have mild hypothyroidism. And the question is kind of these, they don't really have symptoms, but should those women be treated in pregnancy? What's the answer, Bob?
Well, the answer is clearly yes. This was done at the University of Cardiff, and they found people with mild hypothyroidism. In other words, their own gland was not making enough. And they wondered if they would treat all those women, would it be any difference? And so they researched over 13,000 patients who started 12 to 16 weeks pregnant, and they had some evidence of mild hypothyroidism. So they, an important point is that babies rely on their mothers for thyroid hormone production for the first 16 weeks of the pregnancy. And so it's that early time that makes the difference. So they took these 13,000 women, 263 of them were discovered to have hypothyroidism, were treated with levothyroxine, the replacement Synthroid dose, and they compared outcomes of the pregnancy.
And it was much better. There's less stillbirths. Overall, really improved outcomes.
Right. Very, very.
And no complications.
Exactly.
So this, I think this is something that, again, if you were pregnant and you had a thyroid condition that came back, even if you had no symptoms, it seems as if you should talk with your doctor. Last research that matters, Bob, is about this, what they call white coat hypertension, which, you know, we say, oh, don't worry about it. Your blood pressure is only elevated when you come to the doctor. But is that really the case? Should we really not worry about it? Because maybe it's elevated whenever you're in a stressful situation. And is that a problem? What do you think?
Well, I think it's complex. I think the people that only have white coat hypertension, you probably don't need to treat, especially the younger people. But if people are old and if they have comorbidities such as
diabetes
yep. and then they come up with an increased risk of heart disease if they're over 60 years of age.
Yeah, this was research in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And exactly that, Bob, if you had white coat hypertension and you were less than 60, as they followed these people for 10 years, they did just fine as compared to the people who didn't have this. But if you were over the age of 60, they actually had more heart attacks and strokes. And the real problem was is that they may have actually developed real hypertension and they thought it. So I think if you have white coat hypertension, you may need to have your blood pressure monitored more frequently, particularly as you approach age 60.
And the authors are encouraging multiple blood pressure readings and attention by physicians who are caring for them.
Well, that'll complete the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Alejandro Azofefa, epidemiologist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about monitoring marijuana use as attitudes, behaviors, and legislation change. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Alejandro Azofefa, epidemiologist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about monitoring marijuana use as attitudes, behaviors, and legislation change. Welcome, Dr. Asofefa.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we do want to talk about your recent editorials in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Centers for Disease Control, work that you're doing about monitoring marijuana use in the United States and the changing landscape. But first off, just tell us a little bit about your own background. You are a dentist by training, I understand. How did you get involved in doing research?
Yeah, that's a very interesting career path. I tell my colleagues, in my previous life, I worked as a dentist for almost 5 years. And then I became more and more interested in epidemiology and surveillance and looking at data from rural and urban areas. So during those times, I became more and more interested in collective care than individual care. So after that time, I pursued to study public health, and I went abroad and studied for 2 years public health in Europe, and I got my master's degrees from the University of Copenhagen. After that time, I got selected to be part of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which is a CDC fellowship program, or they call it also a disease detective. There, I got involved in interesting outbreak investigations about influenza, lead exposure in children in Puerto Rico, and I also did some analysis on oral health status among pregnant and non-pregnant women in the United States. Then I worked as a researcher at the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. And then I moved here to the Rockville area, where I've been working, as you said, as an epidemiologist and at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, specifically at the Center for Behavioral Health Statistics and Quality, where I've been focusing a lot of my research on substance abuse themes, particularly on marijuana.
Well, it sure seems like attitudes, behaviors, and legislation regarding marijuana use are changing rapidly. Can you give our listeners an overview of where we are, what this landscape looks like, and how many people are using, and who is using?
Correct. So we have to understand one of the main principles here is that marijuana is still considered an illegal Schedule I drug. So that means there's no currently accepted for medical use and has a high potential for abuse. However, as you mentioned, over the last two decades, more than half of the states have allowed limited access to marijuana and its components for medical reasons. So we have about more than 40-something states with currently legislations on medical use. And being California, starting in 1996, and a couple of weeks ago, we only had four states with legislations with recreational use. We had Colorado, Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. And then three or four more states are joining that group. So we're probably going to have around to 7 to 8 states in coming months.
Talk to us a little bit as both an epidemiologist, but someone really passionate about health. What do we know and what don't we know about the health effects of marijuana use? Because I know, like with tobacco use, there is no safe combustible tobacco use. At any dose, it is harmful. We know with alcohol, there may be a benefit for a small dose. Large doses are bad. What do we know about marijuana?
Well, the results are mixed currently. So what we know from other research, and again, it's very, very limited. The evidence for therapeutic benefits of marijuana are limited to treatment and improvements to certain health conditions. For example, chronic pain, spasticity, and nausea. So, but on the other hand, we know also there are some adverse effects short-term and long-term. Some other colleagues had also noted that the use of marijuana may impair short-term memory, impair motor coordination, which may alter driving skills, alter judgments. In some cases, it may lead to addiction, alter brain development, and might have poor education outcomes. So, you know, it's very hard to to tease out all those details because there has been not a lot of research in the area, but we're learning more and more as, you know, science advances.
As we work to fill in the gaps in the research, is there anything doctors should particularly keep in mind when talking to their patients about the use of marijuana, or vice versa? What should patients know about this evolving environment?
Well, I think doctors and patients should be informed at all times of the current medical science and public health information from trustful sources. Being said, you know, good scientific research from academia, local governments. I know they have very detailed information on some of the health effects that they're seeing at the state level, and also, you know, some federal agencies that who are currently looking at these type of research, for example, NIDA and others.
The National Institute of Drug Abuse.
Correct.
So let me ask you a question in terms of research. Is there a difference really in terms of medical versus recreational use of marijuana, and should we be approaching researching these types of use differently?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer is we still don't know because we haven't looked at those particular items in the literature right now. So we're understanding more and more in terms of patterns of use. We're trying to understand and make the difference between those who uses marijuana for medical purposes or for recreational purposes. So I believe there's one research done that highlighted the type of users, but again, it's hard to know. You know, when a customer goes in and try to tease out, you know, those type of differences of strains, it's hard to know. You know, and I always debate this with colleagues. It's, you know, what's the right amount or the dosage to prescribe for a particular condition. So, you know, I think right now the research is has a lot of gaps, and potentially as we see more and more the research understanding these patterns, we'll have those answers.
You know, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I hope we can really pick up on some of the issues that you raise in your article, then you just alluded to, you know, when you talked about kind of the mode of use. Is it smoked? Is it vaped? Is it eaten? Is it drunk? How does that influence? These are really important and interesting issues. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Alejandro Azofefa, epidemiologist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about monitoring marijuana use's attitudes, behaviors, and legislation change. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. Bob and I have been talking with Dr. Alejandro Azofefa, epidemiologist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about monitoring marijuana use as attitudes, behaviors, and legislation change. And right before the break, Dr. Azofefa, you were talking about kind of the research and how little perhaps we know about kind of, you know, how people use the product. Give us an example of how it may differ, I guess, and what we don't know. What don't we know about whether or not it's smoked or vaped or eaten or even drunk, I guess, with liquid?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, after doing a search on the literature and probably a good consensus of experts nationally, we have a lot of gaps in the research and surveillance data. So there's still a lot of question marks. We still don't know anything about mode of use. I mean, we don't know how people are either smoking more, vaping, dabbing, or even eating. We also know that they're also making drinks out of extracts of marijuana. So those kind of questions we'll still not capture in any national data set. And so we're still interested in knowing those type of information to make informed decisions. The other part that it's still a big question marks is the quantities of marijuana use, not just the number of days use and the reasons, you know, something that we mentioned previously of why people are using medically or recreationally. So there's still a lot to work, and we're working to improve our surveillance systems and to launch new systems if we have to. And we also have to think, you know, being innovative partnerships using healthcare systems, hospital and emergency department data sets, and perhaps even non-healthcare sectors, for example, education, transportation, law enforcement. There's a lot of things that we still need to understand about the use of marijuana, the health effects, the therapeutic uses, the relationship with other substances, the mental health component, the injury risk. We need to understand and the importance of driving under the influence of marijuana. And one particular that it's not even captured is secondhand smoke and exposure effects of that. So there's still a lot of question marks, but I think this type of data that we presented here with the MMWR will give us a good guidance, a good baseline for decision-making, and to see if patterns of use of the current indicators that we have, are we going to see any changes? Are we going to see decreases or increases, and start monitoring those kind of behavioral changes in the U.S. population.
So I was interested that you were involved in a recent study in which you found that middle-aged adults were more likely to smoke than their teen counterparts. Tell us about that and what changes it makes for the future.
Right. So it's important to understand that this type of data are closed questions. So we don't know the whys. But with this type of data and collecting different types of items or indicators, we are more likely to understand a little bit of perhaps the differences between populations. So what we know is that use among teens, 12 to 17, is decreasing across the board, and it's been decreasing for almost 13 years. Although people 18 and older, it's increasing. So one of the things that has been noted in other research, but we also echo that in our findings, is that the perception of great risk from smoking is decreasing across ages. So perhaps we are seeing that people might think or are thinking that perception of risk is decreasing, or it's not as harmful as they think, and they might use marijuana for those cases. The other one is the one interesting finding that we found was the perception of maximum legal penalties in your state for the first offense for the possession of an ounce or less of marijuana, and that's being a mandatory prison. That perception is decreasing across all ages. So that's another piece of information that could add to the puzzle to see why are people changing perceptions for use. But again, we still need to understand a lot of other types of environmental social events to really tease out that. I mean, the best question is to ask, why do you think you're using marijuana? But it's very, very hard to capture in a big national survey.
You know, I'm thinking back, tells my age, but in 1978, when I was a senior in high school, I remember a statistic saying that that was the highest rate of kind of regular marijuana use in the United States, and that something like 60% of high school seniors were using marijuana monthly at that time, and it kind of went down over a long period of time. And I guess it raises the question, as a researcher, as an epidemiologist, are there concerns that the changes in legislation or the legalization or attitudes or perceptions of harm are likely to drive those rates differently again?
It's hard to know with this type of data that we have because we don't ask specifically for that change of behavior. But some other research have noted that people are more informed and are keeping track of all the politics and policies changes in their states. So that might help them to make that choice of using marijuana. But it's hard to know with this type of data that we have. So perhaps if focus groups or other type of methods could help out, you know, why people are changing that perception.
You know, I want to ask you one question, both as a dentist but also as a public health researcher. Is there any research on the kind of dental effects, positive or negative, of marijuana use? And then with the public health and the liquids coming about, and I'm thinking about vaping in particular, and the liquids and the poisonings of e-liquid, are we seeing the same sort of thing that we see with electronic cigarettes with cannabis from liquid?
Yeah, and again, like I said, it's hard to know. We don't have any data in terms of the e-cigarettes and use of liquids. I think those are very, very important questions that we have to ask ourselves and perhaps modify some of our surveys that we have but help other state-level researchers to tease out that, you know, patterns used in states may differ. Some people might use it, you know, one mode, but some other people in other states might use it in a different mode. So that is important, and that's why it's so powerful to have this type of survey and to ask across the country and to understand patterns of use and try to understand the patterns by state level data. In terms of dental care and the use of marijuana, I haven't seen much. It's very unlikely there's a big amount of data around that. But I think as we learn more and more, people are going to be interested in knowing those effects on the oral health. And again, I think people need to understand that good health starts in the mouth. So we'll see how that sees out.
Dr. Azafedetfa, if there's one thought you'd like to leave our listeners with as we close, what would it be?
So it's interesting to see all the data that we collected, and despite the decline in marijuana use and initiation among those aged 12 to 17 years old, the general public should be reminded that marijuana use may lead to both addiction and other health consequences, especially if used at early stages of life when the brain's still in developing. Also, the general public should be should make informed decisions if they decide to use marijuana. So it's important to keep up with the scientific and public health evidence and keep looking at local health departments' website and any health alerts or any news about marijuana in their states.
Thank you so much. It's really helpful to have a rational and scientific voice to something that could be otherwise, and we appreciate all the work you're doing.
We've been talking.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Alejandro Azafedetfa, epidemiologist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about monitoring marijuana and its uses as attitudes, behaviors, and legislative changes. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Thank you.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Bob, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about a listener who's concerned about childhood vaccinations.
I have a newborn whom I will be vaccinating on a doctor's schedule. I'm a first-time mom, though, and I worry about all the other people out there who aren't vaccinating these days. How do I keep my son safe while he builds his immune system until he can get his shots?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that parents have so many things they're worrying about. Bob, you've been a parent. I've been a parent. And it's a scary time. And then, you know, you're coming in for a well child physical at 2 months, and you're going to, in most cases, get a lot of vaccinations. You might get a rotavirus vaccination, a diphtheria, tetanus, tetanus, pertussis, haemophilus influenza, pneumococcal, inactivated polio. You know, these are a lot of things that are happening, and that's just the very first set.
But you got to realize at first you as a pregnant woman developed some proteins and immunoglobulins that when your baby for the first 6 months of life is benefiting from your immunities. As that wears off, then we start giving these actually before they wear off.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, thinking about immunity, if you're breastfeeding, the child's going to have greater immunity. So this is a great opportunity to review recommendations. And we did some, a show recently where we talked about breastfeeding and the benefits and encouragement of that. What do we do about parents who feel differently, who choose not to vaccinate? I personally, and this is a very emotional issue and not a straightforward one, I encourage and talk with them because can I say that their child's going to be worse off? Well, maybe. Certainly your child, if they get exposed and the other child was not, they could catch it from them. So there are real issues here and real concerns.
And we have some diseases that are really serious because there have been outbreaks of measles in this country, and that's a potentially lethal disease.
Yeah. So thank you so much for that question. We say congratulations. We're excited for you. Send us a picture of what the newborn looks like, preferably before the shots. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've noticed that every time we fly, my 12-year-old daughter seems to be getting more anxious about it. At what point do I talk to her pediatrician about her developing anxiety?
Well, you know, as a primary care physician, I kind of like to know when stuff is going on with my patients. So I think pediatricians would probably like to know ASAP, and they can talk to her about that and see if there's something they can do. Another thing to say is that that's a fairly common situation that kids are anxious when they take off. Sometimes it's because they've got problems with middle ears and it hurts to take off and that sort of thing. But mostly that's probably not the case. And it's just the fact that they're up in the sky and they're not in control. And so there are some good cognitive behavioral techniques one can learn to try to make the anxiety better and or less, and tell her that it's perfectly understandable that you need her to talk to you about it and maybe your pediatrician.
Yeah, I think those are great recommendations, Bob. I also wonder a little bit if perhaps the teenager has been watching any movies about crashes, reading about crashes in the paper. You know, these things, once, you know, I don't like to read about a car, airplane crash right before I fly. It's like the worst thing in the world, you know, for myself. And it doesn't really help there. I also remember when I was a young child that, you know, people are sometimes superstitious. And I know that when I was flying with my parents and my aunt and uncle, maybe this happened with you, I would always fly with my aunt and my cousin would always fly with my mom. They, you know, the parents would split up. And so they passed on the certain bit of anxiety and phobia here. And I think you're absolutely right. Talk about it. I love the idea of doing some meditation, a nice book to read, doing some writing. I write sometimes when I'm flying on the back of, you know, those bags, those airplane bags, some call vomit bags. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the best description, but it does help calm me down.
Yeah, it's something to do.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that question. And I think Bob and I say, go on and talk about it. along with our very next house call about eating healthy.
I eat fairly healthy and have good lifestyle habits. I do take a few daily medications and supplements, but I don't like to take any more than's necessary. Are there any benefits to taking a daily multivitamin?
Well, we are thrilled that you are eating healthy and have good lifestyle habits. That's a model for healthy living and growing and getting older healthy. What do you think about this idea, Bob, of multivitamins?
Well, there's not much evidence to show that it helps anything. Probably doesn't hurt anything either. I have to admit that I do take a men's multivitamin once a day to make up for my occasional slips on my diet where I don't cover everything. But it's not necessary, that's for sure.
Yeah, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, kind of that expert authority that kind of ranks and kind of gives us, you know, guides, says there's really not sufficient evidence for or against taking multivitamins, and actually the majority of supplements either, no evidence for or against, with the exception of beta-carotene and vitamin E, for which they recommend against routine supplementation because of some adverse health effects in terms of cancer and potentially heart disease. So I think that's important information. I tell most people, if you're taking a multivitamin, and you may just pee it out if you're taking too much and you don't need it. And if you're eating a really good healthy diet, maybe you don't need it, but maybe it doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, I've heard it said America has the most expensive urine in the world, you know, with all the things that we manage to excrete through our kidneys, including vitamin pills.
And I would say, and you probably will agree with me, Bob, you don't need to be taking the brand name if you are taking. You probably could take a generic. What do you think?
I agree.
Great. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My father told me his doctor has recommended a hip replacement, but he wants a second opinion and he wants me to go with him. What questions should we be asking?
Well, that's great. Bob, let's go back and forth. What's one of the questions you would ask if you were taking your spouse for a second opinion?
Well, first of all, I'd want to know what the problem being treated is, probably pain, and what's been done in the past, what kind of workup has been done, or somebody just sort of made the decision to make this big intervention. For other reasons than it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I agree. I'd like to know, what is the risk of the procedure? Because there's a risk of not doing something as well as a risk of doing something. So I'd want to know what that risk is.
And I would hope that there's a primary care physician involved with this patient so that he could sit down with him, examine him, and make that determination. And then maybe refer him to somebody that he thinks would be really good, because they're able to work with people a lot of the time, and it's good to know the person you're working with. All that said, there's no doubt that there's people who have osteoarthritic changes in the hip that are disabling. And if they have an operation, they almost always, in my experience, seem to get vast improvement from that and not too many complications, although the complications can happen and can be very bad.
You know, one question that we don't really ask in a second opinion and we don't really like to talk about, it's one of those kind of secrets in medicine, is there any incentive here? And we hope not, but is there any incentive both to do a procedure or not to do a procedure, particularly as our healthcare system evolves and so forth? But, you know, your out-of-pocket cost may be a real consideration that you should think about. And so really understanding going out of network could be far more expensive for you. So the first surgeon may be the right advice there. Well, that'll conclude the house calls. We've had a good chance today to really talk about some really important issues that are addressing your health, and we appreciate all of our listeners' concerns and questions. If you want to address something to us in an upcoming show, you can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Alejandro Azofeifa, and great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.